In this episode, I have a conversation with writer Maria Veloso, who integrates storytelling in their advocacy for the environment.
So you do storytelling, you use the medium of storytelling to share your advocacy about creating awareness of whatever is going on in the environment and things that are happening on a global scale. And how do you do that? How do you use storytelling, and how are you able to merge that with this advocacy?
Yeah, thank you. A good way to put it is that in general, advocacy communication its format is, this is the problem and this is what we need as a solution. And it focuses on the large scale, collective scale. Like, for example, the Philippines is one of the most vulnerable countries, if not the most vulnerable country, affected by climate change. And so what do we do about that? First, we need to acknowledge, you know, the different groups who are affected more disproportionately. That's women, the youth, persons with disabilities, poor people, indigenous peoples. And then how do we address that? Through policies and capacity building and empowerment, all of those things. So that's advocacy. But I think that because of that, you know, because of the nature of the format, advocacy is not necessarily addressing people, like everyday people. It's kind of addressing the people in power, right? Because they're saying, this, look what's happening. Please help us. This is what we need from
you're
you.
You're telling the people in power a story about what's going on. Is that it?
No, I'm saying that this is the advocacy part, that's what usually happens in the climate justice space. But when we're doing storytelling and have like poetry, whatever it is, it's talking to just everyday people. So it's making the discussion of climate change, number one, more accessible. And it's focusing on specific people's experiences. So there's this ability to really explore in depth how, for example, a deaf person experiences climate change. Yeah. And
that's so interesting. So the stories come from the people, come from the vulnerable groups. They come from the ordinary person, basically. And these stories are shared to create more awareness that hopefully reach the right ears and hopefully reach the people who are actually doing these things. And I had a, is that right, Naoma? Did I get that?
Yeah. Although that's a goal. That's a goal. We want everyone's stories to be in this, and that's why we're collecting and creating an anthology. Though it is also more often that youth from different sectors are not necessarily from those marginalized groups, but they have a knowledge of those groups just based on their work in organizing. So they can bring those perspectives and share them using their voice. But
that's
yes.
Yeah. So there's that. I love the way that stories and storytelling is such a cultural thing. Now we say kwentuhan, diba? We say kwentuhan. Mm-hmm. We say kwentuhan has so many different aspects to it, no? And it's not just storytelling, as in we're sharing stories, but there are so many different kinds of kwentuhan. There's chikahan, there's gaguhan, lokohan, bastusan, or something, and all kinds of storytelling. And I love that you're using the medium of storytelling and narratives to actually share these, how the environment impacts people. And each one of us, I suppose, are affected by the environment in some way, especially with the changes that are going on, and especially people who are affected also by the wrath of a of nature, the wrath of nature, which is so affected also by our decisions and by our choices. Do you think that do you think that this distance or alienation from nature, disconnection between people and how we treat nature, well, where do you think it comes from? Where do you think this, where should we start looking if we're ever going to make some kind of personal change or individual choice?
Yeah, that's an important question. I would say, just based on what I have learned so far, it's really, it goes way, way back to, so there's multiple movements against nature, or against, because it's all intersectional, right? I see the alienation of humans and nature as a denial of part of our human spirit. So it's not just like, oh, we're alienated from nature and we're hurting nature, and so nature is gonna hurt us back.
Right.
It's not really like that. It's more like we're really just hurting ourselves as much as we're hurting everyone else. And it's a very, it's rooted in way, way back in history. And I'm not a historian, but
right.
I can, you know, tell you that colonization, when that process happened, that was the beginning of many different things, industrialization and globalization.
Right.
And so these, they're all connected, and they started to erode the, I think, the societal structures that we had at the time, which I believe was largely in harmony with nature, you know.
I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting how I was reading about the Sierra Madre mountain range and whatever's going on there, you know, the Kaliwa Dam being already built to cut through this, this protection that we have against the typhoons that come. And you hear stories from the Dumaguete Remontados about how they are connected so much with the land, and that they see themselves as, you know, you're not taking so much from the land, you're just taking enough to sustain yourself. And it's about that, what's enough, you know, what is enough for us? Because as you mentioned colonialism and how it's all about take, 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 consume, 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 expand, gather land and steal these commons and take it for ourselves. And this is what I think I was talking about when I mentioned Kanina about alienations, because we've become so afraid of being alone and being forgotten in history and being separate from other people, that we've started extending ourselves by consuming things, by colonizing other spaces, by placing our mark on other things, all the way to the moon even. And in the past, it comes in the form of colonization. But I want to go back to something interesting that you mentioned. You know, we're hurting ourselves when we're hurting nature. And you said that it's not about, when I do something, nature's going to react to us. And when I do something, nature's going to hurt us back. But it's, you mentioned something that kind of implies a sense of, I'm with nature and I'm part of nature. So if I do anything, it's actually just me doing it to myself. Is that right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's exactly the way I see it. You know, everything is connected. We're not separate. Like, it's, We're not separate from each other as people, but we're also not separate from every other living being.
And we've forgotten that, no? We've forgotten such that important truth, which I think is so common in Philippine culture also. And it's so apparent in our superstitions. When we cross a forest, we say tabi tabi po because we believe that there's some kind of spirit there. And that implies some kind of spiritual relationship with nature, even though now, today, it's just a compulsion not to point at old trees, for example, because someone's living there, not to cut down ancient trees, or when you're building a house, so you build around it, diba? And these things related to nature are so, they imply our deep respect. And what one exorcist, I was reading this book on exorcism, and it was talking about how spirits of the earth are in some way demons, from a Christian perspective, of course. And so they demonize spirits in nature. And he used the term reverential fear. So they say, you shouldn't fear these demons because, you know, you have to believe in God and God protects everyone. But the thing about that is this term that he used, reverential fear, is exactly the feeling that we have or that we should have with nature. A reverential fear, a respect, but also a kind of, you know, there's that terror also that nature is so beautiful and mystifying, but it's also so dangerous and it can be, cause all these devastation and destruction. But at the same time, it's part of that process, no? It's part of that process of nature also, to that cycle of birth and death and creation and destruction that humans have inserted ourselves into, that process, that natural process that goes on, and humans have inserted ourselves into that. And now, today, everything that goes on, we can actually point to humans as the cause for these things. Iba? What do you think of that? How do you feel about that?
Well, I really liked what you said about we're afraid. Like, that is perhaps an explanation for colonization and all of this consumption that humanity has been doing. And granted that it's not every human, right? It's, we have to recognize the so that it's certain people who are doing this, certain groups of people at the top who are leading this process. I think it is, there is some sort of fear there of our own mortality and wanting to be immortal, wanting to rise above nature in a way that completely backfires on us.
Yeah. The dominating of nature turns out to be, because I think it comes back to our relationship with the world. I remember what Alan Watts said. He said, we don't come into the world as if, you know, we came from somewhere else, but we grow out of it, kind of like a flower that blooms, like a leaf from a tree. And so we've been so, I don't want to use the word brainwashed, pero seguro we've been so used to the idea of our own consciousness, of our own mindset, and it's just me here, that we believe that we're so separate from nature and that we're so separate from the world that we come into the world, but we forget that we are part of the context. And we wouldn't have gone from anywhere else, come from anywhere else. We're just from here, from this whole thing. And so our being is part of this whole wonderful web of life, and nature experiences itself, the universe experiences itself through us. And that's the only reason, I think, the only real reason why we're so fragmented, is because if things weren't fragmented, we wouldn't be able to experience ourselves. And so our experiencing of nature is nature experiencing itself. I know it can be kind of mystical, no? It's a little bit floaty and these ideas, but I love how grounded your work is, and I love how grounded your beliefs are. But at the same time, me hearing that already reminds me of so many spiritual implications. Do you find that your work is, you know, spiritual in some way? Does it connect at all with your spirituality?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I
How
mean,
so? Yeah.
my boyfriend laughs because I told him once that I said, I feel connected to that mountain.
That
And
mountain.
it's Mount Balakbak, because there was one time we went on a hike and we learned about the forest guardians. I forgot what they're called. The Bantay Gubat, who, yeah, basically protect and reforest that mountain.
Right.
I've had like a long journey with my spirituality, so I've sort of landed in this spot where I feel really, really connected to nature, and sometimes I find that I have to sort of tamp it down because
Camp it
if
down.
it's as in because
Yeah.
It can feel really painful when
Painful.
I witness the destruction of nature. And I know that sounds kind of cliche maybe, but if I do feel very connected to nature, right, then it's logical that for example, seeing a mountain be stripped for mining and quarrying purposes, it does make me feel sad and mournful. And I guess sometimes that's why I have to, or naturally as a response, I back away from that a little bit. But it always comes back in this work, and especially when I literally go out into nature.
How would you say your relationship is with the world? How would you say, how are you connected? You say that you have a relationship with nature, and how does that manifest usually?
I think it's so there's my theory of the world, as in what I believe, my philosophy. But then there's the way I live, right? And those two are very different. I would say that my philosophy is that, well, I am a Luddite, so I am against technology and all forms of technological progress.
This might be kind of ironic since we're doing this online.
Yeah, well, that's why, right? My life, literally, I cannot just, you know, leave society as I know it and like go into the forest, at least not now. I need to prepare a little bit before I decide to do anything that drastic. But I love your question. It's a very deep question of how I relate to the world. I think I try to come from a place where I know that I'm not permanent here. When I die, I'm gonna be decomposed and come back to the earth in whatever shape or form, maybe
From dust
in
to
the
dust.
dirt. Yes, exactly. And that, I'm now trying to think, how does that make me relate to other people?
Oh, it's interesting that you say that, because so your relationship with nature, you think, is also connected to how you relate with other people? People being also part of the world, right? People also being part of nature.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to form my thoughts in order to express this properly. But I think I'm at a place right now where I actually don't like to call myself an activist as much as possible. I mean, it's still a word that people understand, so I can use it. I often use it just for simplicity's sake. But Activist implies that I have to make a difference, that I have to change the world.
Interesting.
And I think when it comes to changing people, I've stepped back from that, or I've changed my belief around that. I think because of the way that I connect with nature and because of my philosophy. And like you said, if people are nature, then I mean, I can't antagonize people. Like, I can sort of be at peace with whatever's happening in some way, not completely, but be at peace because whatever is happening is, in a way, natural as well, right? Like, if we do believe that people are nature and people are as natural, like, there's this pretty famous article about how cities, urban cities, are natural. There's nothing unnatural about the urban city. And I
I believe
forget.
that, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's more like, how do we live? How do I live with all of these different worldviews and this increasingly compartmentalized world? Acknowledging that whatever is going to happen will happen, and I don't have to change that necessarily, that I can just be witness and do what I do, which is make art.
Act in a natural way also as your own human nature.
Yeah, it's a bit, it's all a bit like,
Yeah,
how do we explain this properly? But
I know
yeah.
it's hard to, I don't know, it's hard to grasp ideas that are intuitive, that are really just something that you kind of sense and feel and understand in a heartfelt way. But I think I want to make a comment on what you said. When people say talk about human nature, because you mentioned how urban landscapes are also natural nature, and how human nature, we think, no, a lot of us say, when we want to let go of the ego, of the shackles of civilization, letting go, liberating ourselves from the limitations of society, we usually think of it as a movement or return to the primal and the beastly within us, you know? And it's always about when we let go of the ego, we always want to go back to the primitive selves, the primal, beastly, raw, essentially the caveman self. But then if you really think about it, no, human nature is to create societies. Human nature is to build things, to have architecture and create art and make music and dance, and that's part of human nature. And it's not just, you know, it's not just,
Definitely.
yeah, but it's not just going back to that, you know, growling and gathering and hunting and gathering and that kind of stuff. But yes, that's also part of human nature and part of human history, a very important part of our evolution. But also the towers and the buildings and the streets, as much as it can be inconvenient and unsafe, it is still part of human nature. And I think that we're just making a glorious mess of things in a very human way.
Glorious.
Yeah, it's glorious, it's beautiful, but it is a mess, you know.
Yeah,
Kind of like
I
how,
agree.
yeah, what do you think of that?
Oh, that reminds me of this quote from Sophie Strand. And if it's okay, I'm gonna take some time to look for it because it really applies to what you just said.
Yeah. Sophie Strand. Oh, that's interesting. Fia, why do you look for that? Because it's so interesting also that in Filipino belief, our folklore is not just limited to nature. We also find spirits in the urban landscape. So we have urban legends, right? And so we still have spirits in the cities. we still have, you know, white ladies, duendes, and they don't just exist in forests. They existed in households. And when you lose an item and then you find it after a long search in the place that you initially started looking, that's a duende, or so they say. And I was speaking with some people in from the farm, and they told me that, you know, in every household, there's two families, and one of them is not human. And so there's always this encantos, these encanto spirits in every household. So it's even in the urban landscape, even in the concrete jungles of our consciousness, there still are spirits. So it's human nature. Anyway, did you find that quote by Sophie Strand?
You know, I did not. I lent that book to someone. So
oh, now, I'm curious, man. Now I'm curious about what the
I let is. Me try to paraphrase it. She says that the opposite of our civilization is not some return to Paleolithic hunter-gatherer type societies. And the opposite of patriarchy is not a matriarchy. So when we essentially, she's saying, when we're identifying the problematic nature of our current society and the systems that we've created, we can't just say, oh, let's tear it down and let's go back to what we had before.
Right. Exactly.
It has to be it's something else. We have to create something else entirely. And she says, the words she uses, it points towards a wholeness, togetherness of everything.
Yeah. Ganda. And you know, it's just that thing. And I think there's this philosophy called deep ecology. I'm sure you know this, naman din. You in deep ecology, where we believe that we're part of nature and that everything is going on their own path of self-realization, essentially finding completeness in each other, self-realization. And
I like that. And
that whole thing, you know, about being one thing, this whole thing being one thing. I do believe that. I do agree with the idea that this is all one thing, but it needed to be fragmented so that you could see one thing from another perspective, like black and white. There's no way you can see white without seeing black. And so it's kind of like a letter on a blank page. If it's a white letter on a white page, then you won't see anything. You need that black letter, or you need that white page to see that black letter. That's another Alan Watts metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it all is connected with each other. It all is related with each other. And so when we consider the self, we can never say anything about ourselves if we don't connect it with what is not ourselves. In other words, the world at large or other people. So nature is essentially, the universe is essentially fragments of itself experiencing itself. And which connects with the way that you're also talking about how when we hurt nature, we're just hurting ourselves, because we are nature and everything we do is nature. We're just following our sense of being.
Yeah.
That's nice, though. That's nice.
I like that. Fragments of itself experiencing ourselves. It's very meta and absurd.
Yeah,
and
it
funny.
Is absurd. A lot of it is, a lot of it really is, you know, all these floaty ideas. But grounding it in reality, you know, we have to remember that these are not things that are so strange, because these are the lived realities of a lot of indigenous groups, a lot of people who live off the land, a lot of people who are in areas where nature sustains them, like fishing villages, for example, where they don't take all the fish in one go. They at least allow it to. There's this folk custom that when you catch a fish, you spare one, and so that it tells the others that, you know, about this whole thing. So you always spare one fish, it's one of the folk customs, which is so interesting, you know, because we really see ourselves as it's about sustainability then, you know. It's about sustainability, and it's when we talk about, you mentioned Ganina about colonization, and I talked about consumerism, and it's really all about a fear of not having enough. And it's difficult to actually listen to that voice within us that says, okay na yan, actually, okay na yan, that's enough. It's good enough to feed you and the people that you love at just the right amount today. And I think, not to make it cheesy, you know, but it reminds me of that, of the Lord's Prayer, also give us this day our daily bread. And it's about receiving that trust, that providence every day when you're living off the land and carefully sustaining yourself and maintaining the land so that it keeps sustaining you. Oh man.
The fear part of it is something that my mind lingers on. Maybe we've been so afraid of death that that fuels our need for more. Like, we want to live forever, right? Like, people talk about medicine in the future, and they're excited because they think that our technology will get to a point where we'll extend our lifespan by or double our lifespan. And I'm just like, do we really want that?
You know what it is? I'm coming again from Alan Watts, who says a lot about these things and talks a lot about Eastern culture and bringing it to the Western audience. Again, he says that death is not really the end of life. It's like the exhale after an inhale, but it's all one breath. And so you're exhaling because without the exhale, you wouldn't be able to inhale at all. And knowing the up and down, the peaks and the valleys of life and death, like it's always one without the other. No, it's always one with the other. You won't be able to know life if you don't know death.
Yeah,
Part of the
exactly.
cycle of nature also, you know, life, death, creation, rebirth. When someone dies, someone is born. And in nature, it's, you know, here's something interesting also. In Filipino folk healing, there's this concept of there's a notion of conservation of illness. So when someone gets sick, the folk healer doesn't really destroy the sickness as we do with germs. You know, with germs, we wash our hands so the germs literally die. But what folk healers would do is that they would transfer the sickness to somewhere else. And here's a concrete example. Alam mo yung mga lamig sa katawan when we have those knots in our body, and they say it's bad air that is trapped in muscles. And I remember when someone would do hilot on me, they would massage my body. They would keep burping. And that happened so many times na nagpapahilot ako, and they would start burping the bad air. And so it just transfers, you know, the sickness transfers. And I think that's part of nature also. Things don't, you know, energy isn't created or destroyed, it just moves around. And so even with life, and life is literally just moving around, life and death, and it's all part of this magnificent natural process of being.
Yeah, absolutely. I can relate to that example because I got a massage a few months ago where I had like terrible knots on my right shoulder. It took a while and it was really painful to get it out, but yeah, that's the healing process. It's a bit painful.
It can be painful.
That reminds me also of again, Sophie Strand. a lot of what Sophie writes about, I mean, is mycelium, so fungus and mushrooms. There's almost like this reverential relationship or outlook on them because they are decomposers. They're decomposers, but they're also the connectors in the soil. And they transfer nutrients through plants from the soil to plants and vice versa. And they can be part of this network of chemical exchange that is how plants communicate to each other.
Yeah.
So they're basically like this amazing being, you know, part of that cycle of life and death. And
right.
It's a really good metaphor for what we need right now also. Like, how can we be the mycelium of today where we're not just recognizing the toxic or problematic parts of our culture, but actually metabolizing that into something helpful and life-giving?
Transforming the, oh man, transforming decay into nutrition and beauty. Man, it's part of the whole thing, you know? It's part of the whole process of life, death, rebirth, and creation, destruction, transformation. It's part of that whole thing.
Yeah.
Oh man. We've been talking for like 40 minutes. For like, I don't know, like almost an hour. We've been talking for almost an hour.
That's right. My goodness.
Wow.
It's just a lot of this. Yeah,
a lot of
alignment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh my God. See, I'm going to stop recording there.
All
unless
right.
you have something else to end about to say.
Well, maybe I wanted to ask you a question.
Okay.
Because you're focused on spirituality and our psychology. Actually, I kind of lost my question. I think I wrote this down earlier. But you were mentioning a lot of Christian verses or beliefs earlier that actually has some alignment with deep ecology and nature. How do you see this philosophy of deep ecology showing up in Filipino spirituality, like in our everyday?
Yeah, like I mentioned, it really is about our what we call superstitions, but I'd like to believe that these are really just indigenous beliefs and an indigenous reflection of our relationship with nature. And so, you know, like when we say tabi-tabi po, when we cross a forest, or I still do that, by the way. I still, like, it's such a compulsion to me now at this point. And I remember when we went out on the weekend, we went to the botanical gardens in UP, Los Baños. And so it was this huge foresty space. And everywhere we kept on saying tabi-tabi po, tabi-tabi po. I don't want to be stepping on some duendes, you know. And I kept telling my companions, you know, stop pointing at the trees, really. Stop pointing at the trees. There's someone there. And I'd always tell them to bite their fingers. But so there's that. I really think that it's our relationship with nature, our spiritual relationship with nature is, in Filipino spiritual belief, is really profound. Because we believe that our ancestors go back into nature, right? as much as there's a world beyond this world, we also believe that our ancestors return to nature. And so there's ancestors in the heavens, ancestors in the earth, in the trees. And eventually, when we forget their names, and when generations lose the memory of these ancestors, they become nature spirits. So we still revere them, we still respect them. But we no longer know their name, but we still pay our respects. So there's that, no? It's so beautiful, the way we look at spirituality in terms of our relationship with nature. Yung mga anito. Anitos are ancestor spirits going back into nature. So Filipino spirituality really is very much very connected with the world around us, which I love.
Right. That's beautiful. I love that you say tabi tabi po.
I say
I've
tabi.
never
Do
said
you
that,
never?
actually. I mean, because I grew up elsewhere, so I guess that the Andes here, that superstition didn't pass down to me.
Yeah. Well, now you know, so start saying it because you might be stepping
Yeah,
on
I do like
somebody
it though. I do like it.
else.
It's just another way of like saying excuse me.
Yeah, but the nature. Saying, excuse me, the nature,
Yeah.
saying, let me pass through. And I think it's also a
Yeah.
respect for nature as well. You know, when you're stepping on the ground, you're also stepping on, I don't know what you're stepping on, you know? So it's always about taking care of being gentle, being respectful of the boundaries of nature, also respectful of the territory. I think there's that, you
Yes.
know. I am more afraid of snakes though, when it comes to like grassy areas. I'm more afraid of snakes than duendes. But hey, who knows? I might step on a duende someday and get really sick. And that usually happens, and those are actual cases in so many places in the Philippines, which is why it's such a common phenomenon, because it's so familiar to us that
No.
people do get sick when they cross spiritual territory. And a lot of our mountains are gods or lovers that have reunited. You know, you think of Maria Makiling, the forsaken Diwata, or the goddess of the mountains, of the forest. You think of Sierra Madre, who is a mother of these children, protecting her children from the wrath of the winds. So you have all these wonderful folk tales, these myths and stories, and your work is about stories and storytelling. And you look at these stories that we've passed down, our epics, our songs, and it's a lot of it really is what's going on in nature. A lot of it really is the spirits in nature, the spiritual,
Yeah.
powerful, terrifying, but beautiful, magnificent aspects of nature. If only we could recover that wonder, you know, and really,
Yeah.
you know, helps us
I think
reconcile.
that's why we need retelling of those stories and adaptation of those stories for current times.
For sure.